Okay. So my title tonight is You Have a Friend Request, Saving Friendship from the 21st Century. For those of you who have been around LaBrie a little bit, this is something I've talked about a fair amount. This is a reworking of a lecture I did several years ago. I also just gave this lecture last weekend at the LaBrie conference in Rochester, Minnesota. And luckily for you, the time constraints there are shorter than they are here, so this lecture has been whittled down a bit for time, so you're going to benefit from that. I think that, as I said, I've done this lecture before, and a couple times, and people sometimes tell me when they hear the lecture that it sounds a little extreme, like does friendship really need saving? And I think it does, but I'm hoping to keep this brief enough tonight that we can have time for a good discussion, because I'd love to hear your thoughts and ideas on the topic as well. In usual LaBrie fashion, I'm going to be saying there's more that I could say than what I'm actually saying. So I'm going to rely on you guys to kick some of that up at the end for discussion. Friendship is a topic that is especially close to my heart. This is an area of life where I feel like God has particularly blessed me. And as a single person who's in my 30s, my friends have been just a critical piece of my survival in my adult life. This is also a topic that comes up a lot in the conversations that we have with our students that come through LaBrie, especially those in their late teens and 20s. In my time as a worker here, I've met student after student who feel that they are all alone as they navigate through life. Some have family members who support and encourage them, but many do not. I've been struck by the number of young adults who significantly struggle with singleness. Not necessarily because of familial or cultural pressures to marry, although those are certainly factors. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more later in the lecture. Or because they necessarily feel like they're ready to get married, but because they feel a really crippling and isolating sense of loneliness. They feel alone in the world, kind of unmoored from anything to keep them grounded in anything that's constant and stable. Several years ago, I tutored one woman who's a student here, and she was really struggling with the fact that she was single, even though she was only 22. And one day, she was in my office talking to me, just weeping in my office, and she asked me, she just said, "How do you do it? How do you do it? You're 30 and you're still single. How do you do it? You're all alone in life. How do you make it through the days?" And I was a little offended, but my immediate thought to that was, I'm not alone. I have friends, and I have my dark days like everybody else. But I was just so struck with this deep isolation and loneliness that she had, and at such a young, what I think is such a young age. And I feel like I'm one of the lucky ones. I have a supportive family. I have supportive friends to walk alongside me in life. But more and more, this is just not the case for people. Between busy lives, our obsession with technology, and the cultural idolatry of romantic love, I think friendship has really gotten the short end of the stick and has lost its luster culturally, to be sure. Friendship, though it's a common word and idea, it can be hard to define at times. The Greek philosophers held friendship in high esteem and listed friendship among the highest of the virtues, the most fully human of all the loves. Aristotle described a friend as a single soul dwelling in two bodies. And Cicero said, a friend is a second self, which is quite a powerful statement if you think about it. My sister shared a quote with me. I don't know the source, but it says, the quote is, a friend is someone towards whom you can safely extend your fingers in the dark. And I really love that. At the very beginning of the biblical narrative, in Genesis 2, God said to Adam, it is not good for man to be alone. Here he was speaking specifically of Eve in the first marriage. But I have to believe that the God of the Bible, the God who is one with the Spirit and the Son and the Holy Trinity, the God who is Emmanuel, God with us, did not mean that the only antidote to Adam's solitude, and therefore our solitude, was marriage. I think this has to be a statement for all of us in all stages of life. It is not good for us to be alone. I was talking about this recently with my colleague Sarah, and she pointed out something that I hadn't really thought about before, but the not goodness of man being alone in Genesis is pre-fall. That comes before the fall in the Genesis narrative. And so this idea that it's not good for us to be alone is not a result of our fallen state. And I think that's an important thing to hold on to, because it's very much treated as such, I think, within the church. But it's really not the case. There are a few verses in the Bible specifically about friendship. The book of Proverbs gives us several. Chapter 17 says, a friend loves at all times. And chapter 18 says, a man of many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. But I think arguably the most direct and the most powerful verse in the Bible about friendship is John 15, verses 12 to 13. My command is this: love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. Paul Simon famously sang, I am a rock, I am an island, a rock feels no pain, and an island never cries. But this statement of postmodern individualism stands in stark contrast to the message of the Bible. We have been created in God's image as relational beings, to live in relationship with the Father and the Son, and to live in relationship with each other. God has gifted us with each other, and friendship is one of the primary ways that we experience that gift. Given that we live today in this world of multitasking and constant technology and a multi-million dollar wedding industry, I wanted to spend a little bit of time tonight thinking about what it means to have the type of friendships where you can safely extend your fingers in the dark. I'm going to give just a little bit of a short social history of friendship. Kind of a quick glance through history shows us that attitudes and ideas about friendship and community have changed significantly over time, which is not a surprise. Societal advancements, cultural changes, and the evolution of technology have altered how we exist as friends and how we view relationships today. In more recent history, the Industrial Revolution in the 18th and 19th centuries changed the face of how we live in communities. No longer did children and adults share family and work life in the confines of their own homes and villages, but men, and then eventually women and children as well, left their homes to work in factories. The development of roads, highway systems, and automobiles allowed people to leave behind their homes and communities of origin in a significant way for the first time. The development of air travel in the 20th century allowed travel to other parts of the globe to be a reality in a way that it never had been, by boat or rail. As individuals, families, communities, and businesses grew outward, the way that we communicated had to change as well. Face-to-face communication was replaced by postal systems, the telephone, television, email, cell phones, the internet, and now a combination of the last three, which is, of course, the smartphone. The colossal social networking site Facebook is a very easy target for the dramatic changes that we've seen in the ways that relationships play out today. But I actually think it's just one piece in a very long history of technological advancements that have brought us to where we are now. So what is friendship today? I've already read a quote from Cicero, "A friend is a second self." And I have to wonder, if he were alive today, would he recognize our version of friendship as such? I would argue that friendship is much the same as it always was, but we're the ones whose perspective has changed. Friendship is one of the few arenas in life where we don't actually have to play a role. We're not a wife or a husband or a mother or a sister or a brother or an employee. We're free to be fully ourselves, fully who we are, as we are. And it doesn't take much to draw two people together into friendship, a shared interest or a common pursuit or a similar way of seeing the world. When you find another human being that shares that, like, one thing that you thought or that you feared belonged only to you, you have those sort of aha moments in recognizing something of yourself in someone else. And I think that's one of the great human mysteries, which is an attachment to another human being who doesn't share our DNA and also doesn't set our hearts racing. Regardless of who we are, I think friendship gives us traveling companions for our journey through life. And I want to just quickly list four kind of functional, I guess, four functions that friendship serves on a very practical level. The first is that friends serve as our companions. So they're there to help fill the lonely places and increase the pleasure of our lives, as is almost always the case with when something is experienced together in community rather than isolation. A sunset, a humorous joke, a concert, the antics of a child are almost always more pleasurable when they're shared with another person. So our friends celebrate life in us and with us, and that's a really important gift. Friends also serve as our supporters, helping us bear the weight of life and encouraging us through challenges, loss, and grief that meet all of us at one point or another. Friends cheer us on and remind us what we are capable of and who we are, even when, and especially when, we forget it ourselves. The Jewish philosopher Martin Buber said, "The greatest thing any person can do for another is to confirm the deepest thing in him, in her. To take the time and have the discernment to see what's most deeply there, most fully that person, and then confirm it by recognizing it and encouraging it." Friends also serve as mirrors, helping to see ourselves in a more objective way, the good, the bad, and the ugly. The poet George Herbert said, "The best mirror is an old friend." This is scary, but it's quite true, I think. There's a vulnerability that comes with friendship. We allow others to come close enough to really know us, to see the chinks in our armor and the scars and the blemishes and the wounded places that we hide from the world. And then lastly, I think friends serve as mentors, giving us wisdom and advice as we travel through life's different paths. Friends are those who have gone before us. Very often they've gone before us. They may or may not be older, but they're in age, but they're people who've gone before us in education, into marriage or parenthood, in loss, in sickness, in doubt, in faith. And they can really cast light on our journeys and help us to see the truth of our lives as we travel through particular seasons of life. In his book, The Four Loves, C.S. Lewis says that the fact that friendship is not an essential love is exactly what makes it so valuable. In contrast to eros, or romantic love, which leads to procreation, or affection, which is what brings us up in the world, friendship is not necessary for the creation or sustaining of life. Lewis says, "Friendship has no survival value. Rather, it is one of those things which give value to survival." I think that's really true. He and many others credits the survival of the early church in part to the strong bonds between the Christian brothers and sisters, to their insistence on banding together and shutting out the pagan opinions and influences around them. In our current day and time, it seems that we have not been able to protect the bonds of friendship against the opinions and influences of the modern world in the same way. What was once a key ingredient in the mortar that built the early church, friendship today seems to be one of the many casualties of the technological age. A study from Duke University in 2006 found that over the past two decades, or the two prior decades, from 1985 to 2004, Americans reported having fewer friends outside the family. And the number of people who say that they have no one with whom to discuss important matters has more than doubled. Another article in the Los Angeles Times from 2010 said that television shows about friendship or featuring friendship are more popular than ever, though Americans actually have fewer friends. And so what we have there is people watching idealized friendships being played out on TV while they, in many cases, are sitting home on the couch alone, which is, you know, quite ironic there. Harvard professor Robert Putnam, in his book Bowling Alone, some of you might have read that, talks about the increasingly fractured nature of our modern lives. As economic pressures have increased, more women have moved into the workforce full-time. Suburban sprawl has increased commuting time and disrupted communities. The great American dream continues, matched with the rabid individualism that sprung up heavily in the me decade of the 1980s. People work more hours to provide for their families, but also to keep up with the Joneses. To buy the bigger house, which is a haven from the wear and tear of the day, the nicer car for all of that time spent commuting, the vacation so that they can just escape it all. We are more transient, relocating from place to place for better economic opportunities. During the week, many parents spend just a few waking hours with their children. Divorce rates are at an all-time high, and many children shuttle back and forth between different homes in order to spend time with both mom and dad. Then there's the pressure from technology to be everywhere all the time and to be available 24/7. So it's really no wonder that adolescents and young adults have clung to the sense of community that Facebook and other social media technologies are offering. So what I'm going to talk about kind of for the rest of the talk here is what I see as sort of three ways that friendship is kind of framed in our culture right now. And the first two are ways that I think are unhelpful or inaccurate, and then the third is going to be what I hope is a better picture of what we should be moving towards with friendship. The first way that I want to talk about friendship being framed these days is as a consolation prize. By the way, all three of these categories start with a C. I didn't really plan it that way, but they do. So the first one is friendship framed as a consolation prize. And when I say that, I mean our attitude that friendship plays a second fiddle to romantic love. It's no surprise that we are in a time of a cultural obsession with romantic love. We just celebrated Valentine's Day. If you somehow missed the abundance of hearts and pink and red and roses literally everywhere, then good for you. You're lucky. But it's everywhere, reminding us. Hollywood is releasing romantic comedies left and right, and we all get a little skip in our heartbeat when the guy finally gets the girl at the end of the story. Advertising even has a way of connecting anything and everything to romantic love and sexual satisfaction. Yogurt, cars, cell phones, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Sexuality and romance are all around us, woven into literally every single corner of our lives, even the yogurt that you eat for breakfast in the morning when you're barely even awake. It's very easy to blame the culture at large, but within the church, romantic love, and especially marriage, has become a holy grail and an idol in its own right. In so many Christian circles, that has become the goal. So not necessarily heaven, not necessarily the New Jerusalem, but earthly marriage. And most churches don't really know what to do with single people or with their relationships. Single people can often be left feeling like second-class citizens in the culture at large, but in the church as well, big time. There can be this idea that singles are the have-nots in a world full of haves. And like some of the Libri students that I've met, who I mentioned before, single people can often be left feeling that marriage is the only option for companionship. And in response to this, I think it's very easy to go to one of two extremes. One is the extreme of desperation, grasping at the first person to walk by in the hopes of nabbing them as a spouse and therefore escaping a life of loneliness and isolation. But it's also easy to swing in the other direction, to be consumed by the loneliness and the isolation, and to allow a cynicism about marriage and relationships in general to become our identity. In a kind of an odd paradox, in our wedding-obsessed culture, I feel like women especially are encouraged in a very individualistic direction, by which I mean I think the message now is that towards women especially is that you need to be able to attract and get a man, but you don't actually need him. You're fine on your own. So you have to be able to draw him in, but then you can take him or leave him because you don't really need him to survive. You can have a baby by yourself. You can buy a house by yourself. You can have a satisfying sex life. You can stay out as late as you want. You can sleep in every Saturday morning and not have to worry about being encumbered with another person. But this belief, too, I think, proves to our detriment. In a single life, friendships are often viewed as consolation prizes or placeholders until Mr. or Mrs. Right come along, at which point then those friendships can kind of be tossed aside or left in our past. Sadly, the word single is often used as a synonym for alone. But in the Christian life, this is not and should not be true. God has made us for relationship, and contrary to popular belief, a marriage relationship is not the only one worth having. And I want to note here that I'm not at all denigrating the place of marriage. I think marriage is extremely important. I think it's more important now maybe than it's ever been. And I'm also not suggesting that friendship is an exact equal substitute for marriage, because it's not. But I just want to make the point that marriage isn't the only alternative to a life of isolation and loneliness. The following is a quote from an article called Singled Out, written by a woman named Paige Benton. It's a little long, but she has a great sense of humor on this topic and makes some helpful points, I think, too. So I quote, "Singleness is never carte blanche for selfishness. A spouse is not a sufficient countermeasure for self. The gospel is the only antidote for egocentricity. Christ did not come simply to save us from our sins. He came to save us from ourselves. And he most often rescues us from us through relationships, all kinds of relationships. Are you seeing anyone special? A young matron in my home church asked patronizingly. Sure, I smiled. I see you, and you're special. Okay, my sentiment was a little less than kind, but the message is true. To be single is not to be alone. If someone asks if you're in a relationship right now, your immediate response should be that you are in dozens. Our range of relational options are not limited to getting married, on the one hand, or to living in the soundproof, isolated booth of Miss America pageants. Christian growth mandates relational richness. The only time folks talk about human covenants is in premarital counseling. How anemic. If our God is a covenantal God, then all of our relationships are covenantal. The gospel is not about how much I love God, because I typically love him very little. It is about how much God loves me. My relationships are not about how much friends should love me. They are about how much I get to love them. No single should ever expect relational impoverishment by virtue of being single. We should covenant to love people, to initiate, to serve, and to commit." End quote. And I want to say here, too, this is not limited to single people. Those who are married desperately need friendship as well. We have this idea that a marriage partner can and should be able to fulfill all your relational needs, but that's just not true. No one person can do that, no matter who they are and how great they are. We can run the risk of idolatry within marriage, as well as outside of it, from afar, making a spouse the end-all be-all. The idea that you complete me is a total lie, and it's actually a really good way to ruin a perfectly good relationship as well. Those of us who are Christians, married and single, really need to take a close look at our own attitudes around idolatry of romantic love and the ways that we minimize friendship. Wesley Hill is an author and a professor at Trinity School for Ministry, and he's releasing a book this spring on spiritual friendship. And he recently wrote an article on the same topic for Christianity Today with the terrible title, "Why Can't Men Be Friends?" It's not actually what the article is about, but that's the cover story if you want to look for it. As a single gay celibate man, he echoes Paige Benton's thoughts. He says, "I need to know that, come hell or high water, a few people will stay with me, loving me in spite of my faults, and caring for me when I'm down. More, I need people for whom I can care. I'm excited about his book coming out. And those of us who are workers here at LaBrie recently listened together to a lecture that he did on the subject and had a discussion about it. And he's really making a pretty radical call for the church to get much more creative about how it recognizes and honors friendships as a critical building block of the church as a whole. He says, "I imagine a church where genuine love isn't located exclusively or even primarily in marriage, but where marriage and friendship and other bonds of affection are all seen as different forms of the same love we all are called to pursue." I think that if the church, the evangelical church especially, is going to be as focused as it is right now on issues around sexual purity and homosexuality, then we have to take marriage off the pedestal, not to denigrate marriage at all, but to take it off the pedestal that it's been put on and to really rethink what it means to be brothers and sisters in Christ, which is ultimately what our call is and what we're all, when we think about heaven and when we think about the New Jerusalem, that's what we're moving towards as the church. And not just in a way that sounds good on a Sunday morning, but in a way that really does translate to the ups and downs of day-to-day life and can engage our imaginations for our lives together long-term in the New Jerusalem. Scripture tells us that we love because God first loved us. Married people have not cornered the market on love. And the single lives of Jesus and Paul, just to name a few, I think have got to be more of an example to us of the kinds of relationships that the entire body of believers is called to, regardless of marital status. The next frame that I want to talk about is that of friendship as consumerism. It's really no surprise that we live in a consumer-driven culture. And it seems like there's really no part of life that consumerism has not touched. The danger of consumerism, of course, is that we get so used to wanting, obtaining, taking, and owning that nothing seems off limits. As the development of technologies marches forward, it marches forward at a faster and faster pace than it ever has in the past. And it feeds into our consumerism because all of a sudden the world is literally at our fingertips. 15 years ago, the majority of Americans did not own cell phones, and those of us over 30 very much remember life without the modern digital technologies. However, people in Generation Y and down and younger had a harder time remembering life without email or cell phones, and I think we're sitting at a really interesting generational juncture right now when it comes to technology, because we're raising up a generation of children to whom cell phones and iPads are as commonplace as wooden blocks and crayons were to kids just a few generations ago. But no matter how hard we try, none of us can escape the effects of technology. Study after study has documented the negative impacts on our attention, parenting skills, driving, and table manners. Decreased attention is the biggest symptom. Multitasking has become the new gold standard of accomplishment and a virtue in its own right. Multitasking is the most marketable skill for a successful adult functioning and thriving in the modern world today. To say that technology has changed the way that we view and exist in relationships could certainly be the understatement of the year, I think. We no longer need to inhabit the same physical space with someone in order to communicate anything to them in real time. We don't have to be in the same room or even on the same continent. We don't have to look at each other's faces, and we don't have to respond immediately or ever. However, the most frequently reported reaction to the prolific use of technology is the opposite. It's that we feel forced to respond all the time and to respond immediately, often at the expense of other activities that we should or want to be doing. Many people have reported heightened levels of stress as a result of expectation to always be on and connected and to always have to respond. The first time I remember being aware of the changes that technology was bringing to my friendships was in 2005. This was a year before Facebook went public in 2006. The only real mainstream social networking site at the time was MySpace, which up to that point had primarily been a portal for budding musicians to make connections and get their music out to the masses. But non-musicians were starting to get on and to create profiles and connect with other people there. One evening, I was hanging out with my friend Chris at his house, and earlier that day, I had received an email invitation from him to become his friend on MySpace. Actually, I don't even know if it's called friend. I can't even remember what it's called on MySpace, but to connect with him on MySpace. And I had just deleted the email. When I was with him that night and we were talking, he asked me about it, and this is roughly how the conversation went. He said, hey, did you get my MySpace invitation today? I was like, yeah, I did. And he said, so, are you going to become my friend? And I said, no. And he was like, why? You know? And I said, because I already am your friend. And like, it totally seemed like a no-brainer to me. And he said, yeah, but if you're a friend on MySpace, you can see pictures of me. To which I replied, but I already know what you look like. And he was like, yeah, but you can send me messages and things on there. And I said, okay, I have your phone number, your email address. I know where you live. And at the moment, I am sitting at your kitchen table talking directly to you. Why would I be your friend on MySpace? So he relented. We changed the subject. I thought the issue was behind us. How naive I was, obviously. From that conversation, it took less than a year for Facebook to jump off of college campuses and to spread like wildfire. Facebook just celebrated its 10th birthday and now has a larger population than China, which is about the Facebook population as of the end of January was about 1.4 billion people, users, 1.4 billion users. But we need to take a look at what has happened to our friendships as a result of all of this technology. I think the main way that current technology has changed us is that it has changed our posture towards one another, both literally and figuratively. On a literal level, the screen technologies of computers and phones require us to look at them in order to use them. If our eyes, faces, and bodies are inclined toward a screen, they cannot be inclined toward another person. This isn't rocket science, of course, but we tend to live as if this law of natural physics doesn't exist for us. We somehow think that we can be fully present in a dinner conversation while also checking a text message. This is something we talk about a lot at Libri. It's a very, very, those of you who aren't familiar with what we do at Libri, meals are a very important part of our time together and our community life together. And we have had students who come through who can't, and the idea of not having a phone at the meal table is just, it's like we're cutting off their arm or something. It's really a difficult thing for people, for some people, not for everyone. And I think these devices or the portals have become the lens through which we see and experience so much of our lives instead of experiencing it in real time. A more recent twist on our figurative posture towards technology is the advent and rising popularity of virtual worlds and online gaming. Programs such as World of Warcraft and Second Life, and this is so not my scene, so I'm sure there are many, many others that I don't even know about, but those types of programs where you create and control your own computer-generated avatar to compete in virtual battles or live in a virtual world now blur the lines between our real lives and personas and our online lives and personas. At one time, participation in these virtual worlds meant that you at least had to be physically present in front of a computer, but now smartphones allow access to the virtual world 24/7. Further blurring the lines between time and space, between the real world and the virtual world. Sherry Turkle is a social scientist at MIT, and she's written several books about technology and our relationship to it. Her latest book, which came out a couple years ago now, is called Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. And just to plug it, it's a really fascinating read, so if this is a topic that you're interested in, I would highly recommend it. It's very readable as well. Terkel gives the example of Pete, a husband and father in Weston, Massachusetts, so just down the road a little ways, pushing his child on the swing with one hand while using his other hand to chat with his virtual avatar wife in Second Life via his smartphone. Here's a quote from the book. Pete says that it's too hard to talk to his real wife, Allison, about his anxieties. She gets too worried that I might die and leave her alone, he says. But he can talk to Jade, his avatar wife. Pete says, Second Life gives me a better relationship than I have in real life. This is where I feel most myself. Jade accepts me. Jade accepts who I am. My relationship with Jade makes it possible for me to stay in my marriage and to stay with my family. Terkel says, the ironies are apparent. An avatar who has never seen or spoken to him in person, and to whom he appears in a body nothing like his own, seems, to him, most accepting of his truest self. Our need for technology to help us cope with our real lives is alarming. And I think technology leaves us begging the question, what in the world is real? And then I think we have to think, what has all this technology done for our figurative posture? We no longer live the totality of our lives in real time. We live much of it in virtual time. Pete, from Terkel's book, uses the phrase life mix to describe the mashup of what we have on and offline. Instead of interacting face-to-face, we spend our time carefully curating our digital personas, including text messages, so that people only see or hear what we think is the best version of ourselves. Online, we are the stars of our own reality show. Online, people actually seem to care about every minutia of our lives. Online, the world can finally be all about us. We throw something out into the ether, and people respond. They like it, or retweet it, or text it back, or whatever. Online, we are seen. And I think that's a really significant piece of this. Online, our lives and worlds can be whatever we want them to be. Our needs can be met immediately, and we don't have to necessarily worry about someone else. We have connection without commitment. Sherry Terkel says, networked, we are together, but so lessened are our expectations of each other that we can feel utterly alone. And there is the risk that we come to see others as objects to be accessed, and only for the parts we find useful, comforting, and amusing. Today, our dream is to never be alone, but always in control. This can't happen when one is face-to-face with a person, but it can be accomplished by slipping through the portals of a digital life. We cannot control what happens when we are face-to-face with a person, because knowing a lot of facts about a person is not the same thing as knowing that person. People, you know, are beautiful, kind, funny, mysterious, attractive, and caring. They are also messy, difficult, infuriating, and unpredictable. Francis Schaeffer often used the phrase glorious ruins to describe humans. Made up of thoughts and personality and emotions and experiences and memories and hopes, real people are the exact opposite of the avatars on Second Life. And real friends require us to sacrifice something of ourselves. And sacrifice, by definition, is giving up something of value, something that we prize. Often that is our time, our pride, our efficiency, or our inflated ideas of ourselves. When we deal with real people in real time, we will surely be disappointed or hurt or inconvenienced. Loving real people in real time means that the dirt and the mire from their lives will inevitably dirty our own hands and self-regard as well. We must engage the whole person, or people become objects, and our humanity is lost. In a world that has been taken over by liking everything, we have forgotten what it means to love. The Bible itself doesn't talk a great deal about friendship, relatively speaking, though the Bible does talk about love. If it talks about nothing else, it talks about love. But not love as we often think about it, all emotion and beating hearts and warm, fuzzy feelings, like Valentine's Day. The Bible talks about love as a verb, an action that propels us away from ourselves and towards others. The Bible talks about sacrifice, a pouring out of ourselves, an offering, a give and take. In biblical terms, communion. And this is the last and the alternate lens that I want to offer up in contrast to those of friendship as a consolation prize and friendship as consumerism, which is friendship as communion. One of the great mysteries of the Christian faith is the idea of God's economy, that even as we empty ourselves for another, we are at the same time filled. We are not used up. The Bible's strongest message about friendship is in the real-life examples of relationships that it gives us. David and Jonathan, Mary and Elizabeth, Paul and Barnabas, and many, many, many others. But the most significant example that we have for our call to relationship, of course, is the life of Jesus. Jesus had very real friendships with many people, and three of those people were Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. We know that he spent time in their home for meals, and when he was told that Lazarus had died, Jesus wept. In his New Testament translation, the Kingdom New Testament, N.T. Wright translates this verse as, "Jesus burst into tears." And I really love that because this is one of the places in the Gospels where I think Jesus' humanity comes most into focus for me. It's likely that Jesus was crying not because of Lazarus' death, because he knew that he would raise him to life again, but he was weeping with Mary and Martha, sharing in their grief. He was sad because his friends were sad. Jesus also knew disappointment in friendship. Again, many examples of this, one just being the betrayal of Judas, one who had been very close to him and whom he had called friend. He was rejected and misunderstood by many in his lifetime, including those closest to him. We see the role of Jesus as friend played out primarily with the 12 disciples, the men that he spent most of his time with in the last few years of his life. They were the ones he poured much of his relational energy into. Of the 12, Peter, James, and John are the three that Jesus was closest to and spent the most time with. And of those three, there's John, who stands out as the disciple who Jesus loved. Of course, he chose his disciples not only for friendship, but as the men who would continue his ministry and grow the early church after his death. But still, we can learn a great deal from his earthly relationships. Jesus was deliberate about those he chose to spend time with. By spending time with the disciples, that meant he did not spend as much time with other people. By spending more time with Peter, James, and John, he spent less time with the other disciples. By today's standards, when we are friends with hundreds, some might say that Jesus was too exclusive in his relationships and in his friendships. Today, it's almost an insult towards another person to say that they're not our friend, because we're friends with everybody. We like everyone. And liking used to be a feeling, an action towards a particular person or a thing, but now it's something that we do with our computer mouse. Jesus' model of relationship stands in stark contrast to our current Facebook model of friendship, where we collect friends like we collect baseball cards and have hundreds of numbers stored in our phones. His life informs us about what our friendship should look like. It shows us that humans are bound by space and time. We can only give ourselves to so many people, and for some people, even 12 might be too many. Jesus' life shows us that to be friends with someone, we must spend time with them, eating meals, talking, traveling, working alongside one another. The only way we will be willing to lay down our lives for another person is if we truly know them. And laying down our lives for our friends is not a casual suggestion. For the Christian, it's a command. If we love each other as God has loved us, then it is a requirement. We must stop thinking of people as things to be bought or collected, because people are not objects designed for our own use. The work of friendship can be some of the most rewarding work we do in our lives, regardless of who we are. To know and be known, to love and be loved as we truly are, to have companions, to have fun, to enjoy life side by side with others is one of life's greatest gifts. To have these relationships span time and age and stage of life as well. The work of friendship is not always glossy, glamorous, or pretty. Often it is very, very hard. It can be hurtful and disappointing. But that is the work that God has laid before us if we are to follow Him. This is a primary place where the virtual world and celebrity weddings and romantic comedies really deceive us. It is in our pouring out that we are filled. Because He first loved us, we can extend that love to others. In His mercy, God has made us relational beings, and He uses those relationships to sanctify and to change us. He uses those relationships to save us from ourselves. On the last night of His life, Jesus brought these 12 friends together for a meal. The one whom He loved, the one who would betray Him, and the other 10 in between. And He invited them to His table to fellowship together and share a meal. The author, Parker Palmer, has written a wonderful essay about community called On Staying at the Table. In this essay, he notes that the church, that in the church, it is very often either the Garden of Eden on one end or the New Jerusalem that are touted as models of community for Christians and for the church. But he makes the point that neither of these are a good model of community now, because both Eden and the New Jerusalem are without sin. Palmer says that a better picture of community for us is the Last Supper, is Jesus at the table. Jesus knew the disciples because He was God, but also because He had spent time living life alongside them for years. He knew their hearts. He knew who would stand with Him and who would not. But still, He chose to invite them to His table. And more importantly, He chose to stay at the table. And this is Palmer's point. The best picture of community, and I would say of friendship, that we have for ourselves today is this one of Jesus inviting them in, yet choosing, because it was a choice, to remain at the table. And then the following day, the dinner host became a different kind of host, giving up His body, giving us His body, and laying down His life for His friends. Greater love has no one than this, that He lay down His life for His friends. I want to close here. I'm going to just shift a little bit, but I'm not going to recap all that for you, but I want to wrap up here, and I want to close with a quote that is true, but it also made me smile. It's from a New York Times article that was published a couple years ago by Martin Lindstrom, and the title of the article is "You Love Your iPhone Literally." That's the title of the article. And I think it's especially appropriate since we've just come through Valentine's Day. He writes, "As we embrace new technology that does everything but kiss us on the mouth, we risk cutting ourselves off from human interaction. For many, the iPhone has become a best friend, partner, lifeline, companion, and yes, even a Valentine. The man or woman we love most may be seated across from us in a romantic Paris bistro, but his or her 8, 16, or 32 gigabyte rival lies in wait inside our pockets and purses. My best advice? Shut off your iPhone, order some good champagne, and find love and compassion the old-fashioned way." End quote. So I'm going to stop there. And for any of you who might be new to Friday Nights at Libri, we will just open it up now for a time of Q&A and discussion. Feel free to comment, disagree, throw anything back at me. If you need to leave, please feel free to leave. Nobody needs to stay all the way to the end, so feel free to go whenever you need to do that. But I'll just open it up if anybody has anything they want to toss out. Marty? Hi.
I totally agree with what you said about the idolatry of marriage, and that the greatest way, one of the best ways of destroying marriage is to expect that your spouse can be everything for you, do everything for you. I think it's also really important to recognize that in some sense, the best basis for marriage is friendship. Your spouse should be your closest friend.
Yeah.
And be a friend before, you know, before this, before romance happens.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, I remember Sue Morell gave a very fine lecture a few years ago on men and women can be friends. And I think it was one of our students who honestly said, well, you know, I might get married, but, you know, I've got lots of male friends, but I could never marry a male friend. What? Why are we not? You know, that basically, friendship should be the beginning.
Yep.
Of something that may become romantic or not, but the basis for the marriage.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, it's funny, this came up at the conference as well, this idea, and I totally agree with you. I think one of the things that's frustrating, and I mean, maybe there's some churches and communities that do this really well, but I think in some ways it's hard for men and women to even become friends in a way that's not based on something romantic or sexual. At least in my experience, I don't know that the church does a great job of encouraging those types of relationships. I mean, it's a little bit like an eighth grade dance, you know? It's like the guys are over here and the girls are over here, and you sort of don't approach that unless you're pretty sure you want to marry that person, you know, kind of thing. And I mean, that's an extreme, but it's reality in some churches, in some communities. And I think that, I think one of the things that I really appreciate about LaBrie is that so much a part of our days here and the rhythm of our days is working and students working alongside one another. And it's just such a great way. I mean, if you're out in the garden with somebody weeding for 3 hours, you're going to talk to them and you're going to get to know them. And this idea of sort of being able to sort of do life alongside one another, sort of this posture instead of this posture, kind of always, you know. And I wish that, and you know, churches have things, you know, service project days and things like that. But I wish, I'm kind of throwing out a problem without a solution, but I do wish that more churches and Christian communities had ways for men and women to really establish friendships in a way that were sort of real and rooted for something to grow or not out of that, as opposed to sort of deciding from 200 yard feet away if somebody's going to be the one, and then you move towards them, you know.
Just as from a cultural perspective, and from my time living in the Middle East, I know that relationships between a husband and a wife, or with people who would eventually get married, amounts to pretty much zero until the day of marriage. One of my working hypotheses is the level of comfort that men and women do have in the American church is one of the things that actually prevents marriage. What do you think about that?
Can you flesh that out a little bit more? I mean, what?
Yeah. So in contrast to the time when Jesus came, when people would lift the veil and see their spouse on the day of marriage and their proceed in marriage, they had no relationship beforehand. I sometimes wonder if the closeness of male and female relationships and the warmth and comfort there hasn't become a substitute for what should be a marriage.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I haven't thought about that before. I mean, I think, I don't know a lot about Middle Eastern culture, but I think of what I do know of that culture, I think of even Indian culture where there are arranged marriages, a similar thing where you've never met to the day. I mean, I think part of the reason that those marriages last and work long term is because they kind of have to. I mean, they say we're getting married, and it's actually not based on romantic feelings, how I feel today or how I feel tomorrow. It's very much something that has to do with the family as a whole and the greater community and the standing of that family. There's much less of a culture of divorce. That option is just not even really on the table. So I think that's probably a big piece of why those relationships work on that side. I think the other side, as far as the familiarity here, possibly. I mean, I haven't really thought about that before. I do think there is sort of a culture of it's like, well, there will always be another option.
Yeah.
So in that sense of, I think about that less with men and women who are friends, but I think about it as, I read an article, this was years ago. I mean, this is probably years ago. I mean, 7 or 8 years ago, about online dating and how, I don't know how they've measured this, but how people who, and there's nothing wrong with, I don't have a problem with online dating, but that people who were using dating websites were pickier than people who weren't, because there's this idea of where you can kind of look at the people that you've been matched with today and you can kind of go, no, there'll be another set tomorrow, you know? And so people were really kind of more selective and pickier because of this idea that, like, well, there'll be somebody else down the pike, there'll be somebody else tomorrow, there'll be somebody else around the next corner. And I think we live that way in many aspects of our lives. And so I think that piece for sure. I don't know if anybody else has a thought on that. The actual piece of sort of the familiarity, I just haven't given a lot of thought to. Marty, do you want to?
Well, the thing you said now, I think is a real piece of it, which is the sense of overchoice, especially with online things. There's so many people out there. Why would I settle? You know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's partly the it comes back to the idolatry of this idea of a perfect mate is out there for me, you know, I'm waiting for my soulmate, and all these people that I may know well in my church or at work, you know, who are you know, I may have good friendships with them. I have this list in my mind, or this idolatrous notion of the perfect mate, the perfect soulmate. That perfect soulmate does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
That can be a real deterrent to marrying, deciding to marry a real person that you know that stands in front of you, but who doesn't measure up to your kind of list of what my soulmate will look like. And in contrast to a culture where families are really engaged in arranging marriages, and I think the best of them. The young people have a choice. Some places they don't, but in many places they actually do have some say.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be that same idolatry of the perfect spouse waiting for them. You know you're gonna marry, you're gonna work out it, and you're gonna, your marriage. You look at your parents whose marriage was arranged, and yet it's grown to love each other.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no choice because there isn't that whole Hollywood romantic. And a really idolatrous idea of the soulmate. That romantic comedies can be incredibly unhelpful and really unhelpful to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think that perhaps a piece of this particular conversation, something you mentioned earlier, was face to face versus shoulder to shoulder. And, you know, an online dating website, face to face.
Yeah.
Much of church activity, face to face. And yet if you go back to before the automobile, you knew people in town, men and women, boys and girls knew each other shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah.
Nowadays you get that in college, perhaps on some jobs, but in many churches you don't. And one of the French, I guess, potential authors, think that the guy who wrote The Little Prince, or maybe Jean-Paul Sartre, one of those guys said of his marriage or his romance, he said, we discovered that love consisted in this, not in a man and a woman staring at each other's eyes across the candlelit table or something like that. I'm paraphrasing. But love consisted in this, a man and a woman standing shoulder to shoulder, looking out a window in the same direction. And then that speaks of something outside your house, outside of you, a larger purpose, and then shoulder to shoulder. And I would say with our, even forgetting the internet and forgetting all of that, just the automobile, the fact that I work in one town, go to church in another, and live in a different one, means that the shoulder to shoulder opportunities, it means my friends, I have work friends, neighborhood friends, church friends, and they're not integrated.
Right. And we don't live in a shoulder to shoulder way either. We don't share homes. We don't share, you know, we all kind of, we have our own car, our own house, our own yard, our own everything. Yeah. That made me think of the scripture that people throw out all the time when especially when thinking about Christians and non-Christians marrying, but the verse about not being unevenly yoked. And one of the things that I appreciate about that image is the idea of it's two oxen standing side by side, pulling in the, so not facing one another, but side by side, pulling in one direction in order to accomplish a much bigger goal, and one that is vital to the community, right? So this idea of if two oxen are unevenly yoked, then they're much less efficient, they're much less able to do the work that they are there to do, which is plowing up a field for harvest, which would feed a whole community. And we have such an, I think part of it too is that we have such an individualized view of marriage as well. It's like, what do I want for myself, and what do I want my marriage to be, and how do I want that to fulfill me? And we've lost, and I think this is something that some of the other cultures still have, is this idea of the marriage being not just about those two people. It's something that really impacts the wider community. And that's just something we just don't have anymore. But anyway, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I guess a couple of comments or just add some input. I kind of think about, well, here I often wish I had gone to school in Europe, because here we take multiple choice tests. In Europe, I very often don't have an educational system where you write essays. And I feel like my ability, later I ended up teaching in universities and courses my kids, at college level, I had to basically say, this is how you do a thesis statement, write three supporting statements. Right. I didn't even know the basis of thinking. And I'm wondering if you could comment even on, look at how we communicate. And I'm really struggling. I've been on the coast of Maine in the middle of nowhere, kind of away from all the technology, and I'm struggling to join all this. But I don't know if you've ever read a book by Vannevar Bingle. I think it was something about Fran July, that there was a character that needed to, instead of flitting about, needed to, and be this like a shrimp creature, needed to become a tree with roots, and then it could reach the universe. It actually became the tree and could reach out. I keep wanting to, I feel like saying, who's going to deepen? It's hard to have a friendship. It takes work. We know each other in context. And I think some of my best friends came from rock climbing, where your life depends upon that person on the other end of the road. Kayaking, where, I thought, wow, this may be the guy. But I realized, no matter where we kayaked, for days, he always had to have a battle with boat 6 inches in front of mine. And I thought, a life of that would kill me. I remember, I thought, this is fun, I'm going to speed up a little bit. And he sped up, and I sped up, and he sped up. And all of a sudden, I realized both of us were literally dying, going as fast as we could. I'm like, what is it? I'm a guy. And there's something about spending time. And I don't know how that comes. I was actually spoke to someone today and said, I feel like a loser. I look at people on Facebook. It's like, what do I have? And so you see that pleasantness. I mean, I'd love to hear a comment. Like, I don't see, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe people need people that way, but it takes a lot of finesse to learn that phrase or the way to say something or to go the distance with someone that's hurting or to have that joy or to learn to work through conflict. I'm really concerned about that. We're shopping.
So you mentioned a lot of things. I do want to say your very first comment about teaching and education. I'm prior to working at Libri, by training, I was a pediatric speech language pathologist. So I could talk all day long about what technology is doing to attention, cognition, language development in kids, and it's not pretty. And it's the education system. I mean, there's so many pieces to that, but. I think that the spending time is such a key, and that's what, none of us have time, right? Like, we're all busy. Nobody has time. But I think that, I'm not familiar with that Madeline Lingle story, but the image that you shared the idea of growing roots and growing branches, by default, that takes time. That doesn't happen overnight, right? And so, you know, I think I didn't really talk about this as much, but we live in a very transient culture. People don't physically stay in the same place. It's very hard. It's very hard to dig down deep with people when you're not physically there.
I believe you also go to Park Street Church.
I do go to Park Street Church.
Turnover every 3 years.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Boston, I mean, just the city of Boston is more transient than most because of the education culture there. But and I think that I've said this before, but I have one particular friend who our parents knew each other before we were born, and we went through elementary and middle school and high school together, and we did three out of four years of college together, and we lived together for a year. And then I moved to Boston, and a couple years later she was living down on the Vineyard for about a year working and would come up and stay with me and whatever, and she now lives back in our hometown. And she's not one of my best friends. We don't talk on the phone regularly, but she's somebody that, like, I am holding on to for dear life, because the fact that she knows my family, like, she's, as my dad would say, she's got the case files, right? I mean, she's been through kind of every piece of my life with me. She knows my family. She knew many of my friends in Boston. Like, there's so much I don't have to explain to her, and that is an amazing gift. Like, that's such a comfort, but it's so rare. And I think I moved to Boston as a graduate student, like many people do, and stayed. And I've been here for 17 years, which is so unusual. And I've been here longer than most people I know. And I'm not a native, obviously. But I've said goodbye to so many people. I mean, I've said goodbye to so many people. And I think it is such a challenging thing. And, I mean, one of the things that I've heard Dick lecture on community before, and one of the things he said is that the economy gets the best of us. You know, not our communities, not our friendships, not our churches, but the economy. We move for a better job or a promotion or a better cost of living or whatever it is. And I just think how radical it would be if people made the decisions to move or to stay put based on where their people were. You know, I think the church would look really different. And there is a movement in that direction. I think people are seeing, you know, how the transience is really impacting us in a difficult way. And I know personally individual people, I know of groups of people who are kind of saying, okay, we're gonna kind of decide together to stay put here. So I think that's happening a little bit, but it's hard. I think I have to say this because I'm a Liberty worker and I have the floor. Hospitality is a huge piece. I mean, I think having people into your home, having people at your table, having people over for a cup of tea. I mean, we even sort of resource out our time together, right? Well, I'll meet you for coffee, I'll meet you for dinner. And I think even just being in someone's home is a really radical thing, and is a way to know people in a different way than we do. There's a lot I missed in that, I know, but yeah. Nope.
I'm not that old, but...
Neither am I.
As I get older, I remember, I come to realize, like, how blessed I was growing up in a particular situation that I enjoyed. Every summer, I spent my summers at summer camp. And I'm wondering how much... I remember a few talks ago that you did. You talked about kind of an achievement anxiety that we have in our culture now. And I'm just remembering, I would spend my summers at summer camp, and it was always the same group of people, pretty much. It was a local place. We were removed from our parents. It was kind of glorified daycare for 8 weeks.
Yes.
and we'd go home on the weekends and do that thing. So we were kind of free from our parents' expectations, and we were just around each other. It was a Christian camp. We got really, really good at wasting time together in a really beautiful way.
Yeah.
And I wonder, I know, actually, that summer camp in general, it has totally lost its popularity.
Mm.
Like, there's, I'll go back to my old camp sometimes, and there's maybe a quarter of the people that used to be there as kids. And what's much more popular now are more kind of radical experience camps,
mm-hmm.
where you do really crazy things all week long, or much more activity-focused camps where you get better at playing the sport,
yeah.
or learning math, which yeah. is ridiculous.
Right. yeah.
So I wonder how much of that drives, because I know the people I went to camp with, we still all kind of live around with each other.
Mm.
I'm 36 now, so this was a long, long time ago. Mm. We still hang out all the time. We're all still very close friends.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great, and I think that's I think summer camp is a wonderful example of this idea of living life alongside people for a season, mm-hmm. and there's a connection that happens there. I think, you know, camp is unique because, again, you're not under the umbrella yeah. of your parents anymore, and I was it my lecture I did on play? Is that the one
I
you're
did,
remembering?
No, it was even before that.
Okay.
It was the play one.
Okay, because yeah. one of the aspects of that too is this idea that children are never alone anymore. They're always, there's a parent 2 feet away all the time. And kids don't have the same freedom to explore and adventure and get hurt and make mistakes and things. And there's, when I think of my childhood friends, and we just spent hours roaming, I mean, who knows what we did, roaming the neighborhood, and you know, and so much of our connection to one another was doing stuff, and it wasn't mediated by adults at all, and we had to rely on each other and help, you know, there was this creek that ran through our neighborhood, and it was a big thing to try and cross the creek, and the bigger kids had to help the little kids, and, you know, I mean, just those types of things, but we are in a very achievement-oriented culture, and with that comes, I mean, if your goal is really achievement, then your focus is the self, right? So it's you might be competing with yourself, but more often you're competing with the people standing next to you for the scholarship, the degree, the job, the whatever it is, right? And that's starting earlier and earlier and earlier and earlier for kids, and that changes the way that we spend time with one another I think I've never been to math camp, but it's probably harder, obviously. I've never been to math camp, but I would imagine that spending your summer with math camp, you would make fewer connections and less meaningful connections with the kids at math camp than if you were in a camp where you were roaming around in the woods somewhere doing, right? I mean, just the focus is so different.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
I don't think achievement necessarily means competition.
No? Even competing with yourself?
Well, I mean, excellent. You go after that. I work in R&D.
Mm-hmm.
I love my job. I work with people who love our job.
Mm-hmm.
And you very quickly learn that you meet geniuses that you cannot touch. And sometimes you're the genius that no one else can touch because it's your area of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the first commandments. Makes sense, you know, replenish the world. It's the world's a waste place. Be fruitful, multiply, but replenish the earth.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming to understand God's creation and making something beautiful out of, you know, trying to redeem what's here.
Yeah.
And you get to, you can have the joy of, for example, I would argue that debates are a strange contortion of logic, where you're trying to win, you're not trying to learn the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked 20 years in a place where people are trying to learn the truth.
Hmm.
And you don't care if you win the argument, mm-hmm. you're trying to present the truth and sharpen each other by other viewpoints.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I'm not denying that achievement can lead to competition, but I've lived a life that's refreshingly different than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't want to at all, I mean, work is very important, and work is very important. We're called to work. Again, work, not a result of the fall. Work was there before the fall. And so work is a good gift that God's given us, and I think you're absolutely right. We should... All of us, especially as Christians, though, we should really strive to steward our gifts well, to do our jobs well, and to do our jobs in a way that we can take pride in and would be a blessing to others and would please the Lord. So I don't want to minimize that at all, but I do. So I do take your point, absolutely. But I'm not going to back down on the fact that we're living in an achievement-focused culture that's more focused on the self. I think what you're talking about, I think it's awesome that
I
that's your experience.
Rare, but
yeah,
I'm not the only one.
No, you're not. You're not. You're not. But I think it. But I think it. And it sounds like, and especially working in R&D, I'm guessing that your job is one that is quite collaborative. I don't know, but. Sure.
Back and forth, both ways.
Yeah, okay. You know, so I think that that there are opportunities in our work to where we can do that kind of side-by-side work with other people. But I feel like the way, I don't feel like that's the direction that culture is pressing in on us right now.
If you're going to do anything big, you can't do it on your own shoulders.
No, but...
You need something else.
I mean, not everybody recognizes that. Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah.
I'm just saying, it doesn't... And just that achievement doesn't necessarily mean competition.
Yeah.
Clearly it happens.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to point out that those yep. are independent, quite independent, can be two independent things.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Yeah.
What's R&D?
R&D, research and development.
Research and development, yeah. Yeah.
R&D is
something.
That's the type of music. Yeah. Yeah.
No, I think the shift has really been not in what we do, but in how we do it, in the motives of what we do.
Hmm.
I mean, think of a farm family where everybody worked together to make the farm work.
Yep.
Versus an I-centered achievement culture where it's all about me and my success. I think.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's a place, that's another place that marriage has really changed, because in an agricultural setting, people got married much younger and started having children because they had to. Like, you needed to have the warm bodies in the hands to get the work done so that everybody could live. You know, so again, a picture of marriage and relationships being this collaborative thing for the good of the greater, and we're so individualized now that in how we live and then therefore how we relate to one another that plays out. Yeah, Mike.
When you were using the illustration of covenant, I think that that's one thing I've discovered in 4 years of working with believers, that it's been reduced from a laying down of all your interests for what's best for the other or the whole. It's been more interpreted as a contract. And I think that plays into our self-satisfaction mode, that what's in it for me, I'll bring this to the table, what do you bring to the table for me? And so it's sort of this way of trying to guarantee that if you're going to put out, you're going to get. And usually if you're a good negotiator, you get the advantage. And so I think that that's just misappropriation, even the understanding of the term covenant, taking you out of marriage, but in the life framework of the church as a whole, to lay down one's life for their friends. And we were called friends, we were yet enemies.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't really have the context in which the term has its greatest weight.
Yeah.
We've reduced it to a convenience of a negotiation skill.
Mm.
And I think that's something that I've discovered that also isolates and that fosters competition and all of those other things that we find very frustratingly present, continual, even in all the ideals we try to espouse.
Yeah.
And I want to connect that to the comment you made, you know, the covenant perspective, as opposed in an understanding to the presence of God. God never made a deal to go step back 2 yards. He has always been pervasively present. And it is we who have had to be enlightened continually. It's in that same gospel you're drawing upon in John. We're always coming from darkness to light. And that's the revelation that we're looking for, is that, like kind of like Jacob of old, he was here and I didn't even know. Some of them built an altar. But I think the reality is in a human institutional framework, we tend to make choices based on what's best for us, or what we're going to get back out of. So that leads to a transient nature, all those things, because we're shopping for where we're going to need our advantage, even in spiritual things. And I think there's a lot of things, not just technology, but I just think that that is an idea that many in faith for millennia have kept God at a distance, that there's this secular realm, but then there's this sacred place where I go meet with Him. Mm-hmm. And we never let Him invade. You know, that which is perfect is come. Mm-hmm. The revelation that is all God's. Mm-hmm. And I look back to Daniel, and here he's this pagan king is going to chop everybody's heads off. Mm. And Daniel's reasoning, as it's recorded for us, is that everything's the Lord's. Mm. And so then he goes to this leader and says, everything's the Lord's, but here's what it means. Mm-hmm. So I think that that covenant capacity is revealed in how we posture, even to those who are our enemies. Mm-hmm. And all of it. So we have to stop looking for where the advantage is, because I guess what I'm getting at is, when we go into a contract, you're always looking for what is going to be best for you.
Yeah.
But in covenant, you always go in for not what's best for me. Mm-hmm. What's the short straw? I'll pick the short straw because someone else is going to get the long one. Mm. Always looking for that. And the reason that's rare is I think that we have to come to the end of ourselves and recognize that there's a lot of self-examination, that we have a lot of selfish motive for even why we want to follow Christ, and put that on the table too, and let Him confront us. Because I think unless we can get to that covenant perspective of the present nature of God, we can always put it on yonder. We can always put it back before the fall, we can always put it on yonder, but we will never fully engage the creative fruitfulness of we as a collective body without the understanding of covenant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's my opinion, my thought.
Yeah, I agree. You, your comment reminded me of, I've started a couple years ago at the beginning, usually the first week of every term here at Liberty, I make the students listen to a lecture with me called The Importance of Asking Questions by a guy named Ellis Potter, who used to be a worker at the Swiss Liberty for many years. But he says that the two biggest questions sort of in our time now are, what can I get out of it, and what can I get out of? And I have heard that, I can't even tell you how many times I've listened to that lecture. I do it every term with the students, and he says that every time, and it catches me up short every time. Like, it resonates, you know, it resonates with me, it resonates with the culture, and and I think that's right. And I have to just do a little plug too. There's a book called The Epic of Eden by a woman named Sandy Richter on covenant and covenant theology. She's an Old Testament scholar that's just fantastic. We do it a lot with it here at Liberty, but if covenant is something that you're interested in thinking about more, understanding more, it's really wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing. But yeah, thank you for your comment. Yeah.
It's just like, you think that friendship is, maybe in a sense, that we need more friendship. We need friendship now more than ever, perhaps. And in a sense, we're looking at that from another perspective. Because other types of, like, family or marriage relationships, are more fractured in a lot of ways now, it's almost like friendship is being asked to do more, almost.
Mm.
Do you think there's something to that idea that, because the way I see it, I mean, I'm kind of overlapping with some of what you mentioned in some of the conversation we've had, but it seems like to a lot of folks I know, are either single, desiring marriage, but are still single, or are in marriage, so they don't feel a lot of deep connection with their spouse. Or you have kids growing up with, parents with personality disorders or broken homes, and so they're either, not getting the friendship within the family context or the marriage context, or maybe extended family context.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wonder how many of us are kind of floating around and not getting maybe the way God would want us to, getting the friendship from within families or even especially within churches.
Yeah.
And so we almost need more out of our friendships, that puts more stress on friendships.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, I think that we, we're made to be attached. We're created to be attached to God, connected to God, and attached and connected to other people. And that need and that desire is always going to be there. So I think for people who are living in a place where there's a lot of detachment or broken connections, perhaps the need is heightened even more. As to whether that's overtaxing relationships, you know, I don't know. I think maybe you could say yes, but it would be yes because I think we've had a very low view of what friendship is. So, I have a really good friend. She doesn't live in Boston. She's married now. Doesn't live in Boston, but a number of years ago, she was single. She lived in the city. Her family was in North Carolina, far away, and she had a sort of medical emergency that came up. That it was one of these things where she was fine at work in the morning, and by 2 a.m. that night, she was like on an operating table in the hospital and having pretty major surgery. And there was this sense where, you know, she lived alone. She didn't have a husband. Her parents were far away. And I was not working full time at the time. And I didn't have to work the next day. And so our friends, we were kind of like, somebody has to go. She can't be there alone. And I was like, well, I'll go. Like, I don't have to be anywhere tomorrow. Doesn't matter if I'm up half the night. And I've never done this for anybody else, including anybody in my family. But I went and I hung out with her, and they decided to do surgery. And I like slept on a couch in a waiting room thing at the Brigham. The next morning, the surgeon came out and like told me what told me the deal, and somebody said to me after the fact, somebody said, "Oh, well, gosh, I hate that you had to do that." You know, essentially, like, she's not your sister, she's not your mom, she's not your, you know, like, it was this, like, I had really been put out and gone over and beyond to do that for her, and sort of why, you know, and they said, like, was there not somebody else that could have come and stayed at the hospital so that you wouldn't have to do that? And so I think that's so often, I mean, part of that is, again, the high place we put on family, the idea that family relationships are more important, and in some cases they are. I mean, obviously children are vulnerable and need care and protection, and that's an important thing. But I think that's so often our attitude around friendship. And so in that case, like in a case like that, it would be easy for me to say or for somebody to say, like, okay, Kristen was really asking too much of Mary Frances. Like, come on now. You know, and I didn't feel that way. I mean, I was tired the next day, but I could do it. And of course, as a single person too, I thought, well, I may need her to do the same thing. You know, I'm single, I live alone, I'm far away from my family. You know, but I think to say yes, too much is expected, is because we have a low view of what friendship is. I don't feel like I did something crazy above and beyond to do that for her. But I think we should be doing that, you know.
I just was thinking of a way that I would agree with you that it's true is simply that I would say the same thing about marriage, is that the modern world does not put relationship high or modernity. It's economic efficiency, a huge juggernaut going this way, and that brings us high mobility, and it means the local community has been clobbered. And the local community is a place where you can learn year after year to live, do things that are shoulder to shoulder, which you said, Tom, and do things together, and do things where friendship is liable to grow, where good relationships that could lead to marriage are liable to grow. And there's so many things that militate against that, forces against it. And I think of what marriage is, it's the nuclear family. It never used to be just the nuclear family.
Right.
100 years ago, no one ever heard of the nuclear family. Family was an extension. It was a multi-generational extension. And those other people outside your immediate family, were outside your nuclear family, were important to you because you saw them, you grew up with them, and you would die with them, as it were. And the church has been clobbered as well by the high mobility and the lack of community. And the church doesn't, or many churches, there's very little community aspect to them even. And again, what I'm trying to say is that given the sociology of the modern world, friendship sort of stands alone without support. Marriage stands alone without much support. Hugely without support.
which is a big part of how they're both difficult. But I think there's a I wouldn't want to diminish the demands of friendship, mm-hmm. as you said, shouldn't be reduced. But it's not confusing or surprising that friendship is more difficult. Right. Or that good marriages are more difficult. Mm-hmm. So it's a collision with modernity.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, Nikki?
Just comment on that. That within the family of God, they're not just friendships. That we are, you know, Christ has given up himself and his family. And those friendships are within the family of God. And I think that is a helpful way to pin in that idea of what fasting friendships are, or if they require more now. But they are all within the family of God. And that is a gift given to us from God. Mm-hmm. That even if you are family-less, you are still within the family of God. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you.
Yeah, I think there's like a bearing with one another, but then there's also like a dependence, which I think really only can rightfully be placed on God. Hmm. So for me, it's kind of like maybe like a dance between the two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I would agree. I think that's really where we're most uncomfortable, mm-hmm. is interdependence, communally on God himself, mm-hmm. that the Spirit will make happen what we recognize is the deficiency or the mutation that can easily take place.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole idea of community also. And again, this is it, and I have to qualify this. This is rural California, mountain community, two counties, where there's more evangelical congregations than there are gas stations. It's very, very fractal. But yet, there's this mindset that drives everybody that will relate to you as long as you think like they do, or you act like they do, or you perform like they do. So all reinforces all the wrong dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm seeing, and I got to share today, going in a U-Haul truck that would get firewood. And,
thank you for doing that, by the way.
Well, that's what you do. Mm. Isn't that what we be?
Mm.
You're in and out of season. There is no place you're transplanted where you're not hopefully being productive in the kingdom of God.
Yeah.
But it takes the Spirit waking that up in us. And I think that that's one of the most difficult things in our information and our perfection-driven world, our achievement-driven world, is that we don't have all the answers. We've got to come to God with our darkness,
mm-hmm.
and say, yeah, I'm really blind here. I recognize I'm selfish. I recognize that I'm coming to you empty. And he's always faithful.
Mm.
Just say, okay, well, here's something in course correction.
Mm.
The first time I'll do it, I'll put something in it that pushes that very button.
Mm.
But then, if that is fruitful, both parties then recognize it is the presence of the living God in their midst at that moment who is ordering their attention. They individually or interdependently are becoming aware of the covenant presence of the living God, who has never left nor never forsaken. He said, I've been waiting here all along.
Mm-hmm.
And then that mutual friendship is then edified. And I think that changes the face-to-face to the shouldering, being yoked together to behold the face or the presence or the manifestation of God. Whatever circumstance you find yourself in.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that's so hard about that is we cannot control it. We cannot offer it timing. We cannot conveniently say, this will be a good schedule for this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It comes at the most inconvenient times to reveal that although we make our plans, he is consistently faithful to order our steps, because every encounter for the human existence is the encounter of the living God.
Mm-hmm.
That is the mystery of the gospel in us. We're sealed for that very purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And to be set free, to be loose, to simply witness and testify, mm-hmm.
that he is so ever faithful. Mm-hmm. He is profound. And that, to me, that has been the root of discerning a friend who is always a friend, mm-hmm. who never turns his back. There's no shadow of turning. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really what we're all after. We're looking at all the reasons why we are impacted, or all this, it's like going to Normandy and this amazing obstacle course to get to an objective for liberty and freedom. Mm. But yet, we don't recognize that the Spirit of God has already obliterated all that. Mm. We keep doing it on our own unction, mm-hmm. our own posture, our own capacity to comprehend yeah. what godliness is. Mm-hmm. And our righteousness is our dependence. And I think that each relationship is meant to reveal that we come to God from a common place of need. Mm-hmm. And that's why we were never meant to be alone. That's why mm-hmm. God makes this statement, mm-hmm. even before yeah. the fall, that the communion was meant there. And another thing that I think, and this kind of got me in trouble in a congregation, is we come to the communion table and it says, "This do in remembrance of me." And I dared to pray that we would be broken and that we would be poured out. Mm-hmm. That we wouldn't just observe it, but they as a people would be broken and mm-hmm. poured out. So that would be the doing aspect. Mm-hmm. Not just the remembering, mm-hmm. to go and lay our lives down for our fellow man. Mm-hmm. Fellow man, not brothers, just mm-hmm. a fellow man. And there was stern correction, mm-hmm. because that was a convolution of the communion table. And I thought, wow, mm-hmm. how did we miss all of this? Mm-hmm. That's an evangelical world. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying this because our friendship is always rooted in a qualification. Someone's got to earn it. Mm. And God's called us to simply be it. Mm. And it will take a multiplicity of forms. And if we don't censor, we are blown away at the friend we have in Jesus. Because mm-hmm. he brings another part of his body alongside of us. And just, mm-hmm. you can't believe how you're lifted up mm. when that takes place. Mm. Mm. So again, I look at it this way, the difference between covenant and contract. If I don't negotiate with God, then I don't look for the benefit.
Yeah.
Don't try to hedge.
Mm. Yeah. And I think I think this is a place where what you were talking about with in this idea of being present, I mean, is the mystery of the incarnation and the idea that God came down as flesh and blood to live with us and walk with us and be with us in life and at the table. And this idea of real physical presence is a significant one. And I hear your question, and I think it's so easy to kind of fall off one side of the fence or the other. There's people who, there's this idea of like, well, I can't rely on people. I can't depend on people. I have to only depend on God. I cling to God. I only depend on God. And then there's people on the other side of it who really have their people and really kind of skate on the faith of their people. I suppose, but it really is the both and, you know. And I think this idea of the physicality of Jesus and of the incarnation and of what it means to ultimately rest in God and in the life and the sacrifice and the atonement of Christ, but yet knowing that part of the way that the Spirit works and part of the way that He moves in us is through the people. The people of God, that's a really significant thing. Marty?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think having our identity and our sense of hope really in the Lord, then as a sort of primary place that we look for our meaning, for our purpose, for our joy, can enable us to have friendships where I often see, in the same way that people can put too much hope in a marriage, they can put too much hope in a friendship. Mm-hmm. And they become kind of draining Mm-hmm. You know, either maybe you don't have friends who you feel are sucking you, sucking something out because they're looking for too much from you, mm-hmm. that they really need to get from God, and then you can have a healthy give and take friendship. But if you, with our center more in Christ, then our friendship can be not so much about taking, but about giving and taking.
Mm-hmm.
Serving mm-hmm. that person, which then becomes reflective, as you said, you give yourself and you enter yourself in your field.
And it takes us out of that cycle of consumerism, of needing to consume people because we want them to fill something in us. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask this a little bit. I want to go back to something you said because it really struck me. You talked about your summer camp experience, how often it was wasting time with your friends. Mm-hmm. That really hit me because I convicted me because I think it's my educational training background and everything. I do my list of things I've accomplished today. And if I don't get, and usually I don't get two of them done because I make a too long list. And I'm sure it's right. But the idea, I still struggle with the idea that, because the lists are always very tangible things. They're not, you know, when someone comes to your door, just invite them in and sit down and spend an hour having a cup of tea, and because that feels like wasting time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's just so backwards. Mm-hmm. In fact, spending time building friendships, you know, if you've got that sort of achievement list orientation of, you know, I've got to accomplish, then spending 2 hours with a friend just talking and catching up can feel like wasting time. And actually, it's not wasting time. Mm-hmm. It's actually investing in a friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very, just that, when you said that phrase, it just says, it hit me hard because of my own problems with what some people call hurry sickness. There's not enough time to do all the things you have to do. And so, somehow, when you're in that mode, relationships of people suffer. I mean, it happened with my kids when they were little, you know, and one of my little sons. He could always tell I was distracted with all the things I had to do. He would try to get my attention. Kind of just grab my face and pull it up a grass for him. Mom, I'm talking to you. And that, it was very effective. My son, I had to give my full attention, not wasting time, you know, just for that to go laundry and make dinner and make 10 phone calls, you know, actually the most important. So this little boy, my attention, but he didn't have to grab my face.
Your phrase was wasting time in a good way.
Yes.
And that's what we need to get hold of, in a good way.
my view is to try to realize that actually, there are things that I sometimes catch. I think wasting time at all. Actually, investing time in something really more important than all those things on my list that if I don't get them done today, the good world is not going to end.
I worked at a camp once with high schoolers, and we were trying to impart this idea to them, and we called it holy leisure. Yeah. That was the term we came up with, was holy leisure, which is more or less helpful, depending.
Listening to you talk, I was just thinking, I have to do the same thing sometimes, and it's like building something unseen is hard. So, you know, like when there are so many things that take away my attention, but...
Hmm. Yeah, the tangible is easier in so many ways. Yeah, absolutely.
I think I'm going to mutilate this a little bit because I did read it at first. I think that C.S. Lewis referred to the inklings.
Hmm.
And then one of them passed away, and he thought that he would get to know the other person far better now that the other person was gone. If I'm really bad paraphrase, but what he found was that he actually knew that person left something that other person brought out.
Yep.
And I think one of the things that I've come to know, I've been living very rurally in a small fishing town of just under 400 people for 15 years. And in a Christian community where the husbands can't talk to me and the women don't want to.
Sounds terrific.
I just found out my biggest sin was my weight, actually. I'm slender. It's the enemy or something. one of the things that I have found is just being down here in Boston for a short time, I've gotten to know some really delightful women, is I think I just found out who I am.
Hmm.
Is it even happens, you know, you think you would learn less about someone, but I'm finding out, I mean, I'm actually feeling very awkward right now because all of a sudden these women are calling me hun and honey and hey, baby. I'm like, this will be an accident. I don't know what to do. It's just very strange.
Hmm.
But friends really help us know who we are. And
it's that whole thing of friends being mirrors that I was talking about before.
And I think my role and how do I help them to get to know them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the accuracy of what do I report. And just to be truthful and to be a friend and be kind and not just kind, but to be truthful, to help them know themselves and to be that sounding board.
Yeah. It's funny that C.S. Lewis quote you brought up, Marty, and I were talking about that a couple weeks ago, that same quote, but I hadn't thought about this, but I have some friends here. It's a kind of a group of girlfriends. There's four of us that are friends, and one of them started dating this guy back in the fall, and anyway, it's fairly serious, and none of us have met him, and so we've been sort of hounding her separately, you know, like, I need to meet him, I need to meet him, I need to meet him. And she said something that was so interesting, and she said, I don't really, she said, my preference would not be for you guys to all meet him individually, which is what I want to do. Like, I want the, like you and me. Like, we're going to, you know, but she's like, I don't really want to do that. I really would rather him meet the three of you together, because I think he'll understand you. And because there's a sense, you know, we don't care if he knows us. Like, we want to know him and, like, you know. But she said, I think he'll know you and understand you and your place in my life together at a table as opposed to individually. And I thought that was so interesting. I hadn't, you know, and sadly that it happened last week and I couldn't be there. So two of them were there. I couldn't be there. But it was, she said that and I was like, oh, huh. And, but it was such a poignant thing, I think, to say, like, you all are yourselves in different ways in the presence of one another than what you are when it's just you by yourself. And I think it, you know, ties in so much with that quote of we, our friends really are mirrors, but there's also this, we carry different pieces of one another and we reflect different pieces of one another, which is such a beautiful thing, too. Yeah. Anything else?
Go ahead. Just thinking about risk and how that is probably really important, vital in relationships.
I mean, I think we can't really dig in with people, and we can't really get to know people and sort of go the long haul with people without opening ourselves up and being vulnerable. But yet at the same time, friendships and sort of the close relationships in our lives should also be places that we're places of safety. So I think it's finding, you know, it's opening yourself, it's taking a risk with someone that you have found to be trustworthy, I think. And yeah. Josh, did you have a question?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's really worth bringing up the state points and something the Horace and Wood been saying. But I had two very close friends in high school, like very, you know, people inform who you are, type friends. One moved to California and the other to Illinois. The one in California is the very typical sort of occasional email I see at Christmas, you know, still good friends, but not that much contact. And the other, somebody had a particularly special connection with, for some reason, which is very similar. I haven't seen him in 7 years, and we have only communicated exclusively through online text. And yet we still have a really close connection. It's kind of talk. There's just like this instant fondness. There's the sort of thing where I'm going to try to explain something that I know nobody's going to understand, and he's like, yeah, I get this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Finished.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the added element that he's not a Christian, And we'll occasionally have these theological debates, which I love because he doesn't hold his punches. And occasionally he'll admit that I win, which is kind of fun too. But it's just a strange thing because he's very much a person, and yet we'll make these comments occasionally, which is like, you're my little black box. Which is like, you get the Gmail, so it's just a
yeah.
box.
Yeah.
Which is text.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I definitely agree with the ideal friendship being the physicality, you know, mm-hmm. the connection, the community. But in contexts like that, can't afford to move back out here. He's going to be there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably not going to be in California as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really know exactly what my question is or my point, mm-hmm. but I guess this is a strange thing because he's definitely my friend.
Mm-hmm.
Even though for the past 7 years he hasn't been a physical body.
Yeah.
I can make a quick comment. Mm-hmm. I have a cousin who was like my twin brother. He was a farm. We lived on a farm for years together. We coincidentally went to the same college. I don't see him for a long period of time, but we immediately met. The difference is I didn't meet him online. Mm-hmm. I mean, you'll give an example to people who never saw, had never met online.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be my first comment. You build a foundation. And then it's no different than a letter writing was, you know, with Jefferson or somebody else who, you know, who Lewis and Clark or somebody who disappeared for years and write letters or missionaries to new people and then disappeared to China and then wrote letters for the next 20 years. They didn't lack. My opinion would be once you build a foundation, and I'll start off there.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. It's like there's a history there. There's something established. And I think we all, I mean, I'm in the same boat. I have dear, dear friends that I don't live in the same place with anymore, but some of them I'm rarely in touch with, and some of them I'm in regular contact, and we do make a point to see each other and visit and to fly and to travel. And it just is reality of life now. I mean, it's ridiculous to assume that we wouldn't have relationships like that. And I think people are different, you know. I've had friends, even thinking about high school friends, like you gave that example, who were in touch from time to time, but there definitely is something lost in the connection, you know. But then I have other friends who were in touch that way, and when we do see each other, you know, it's that phrase, it's like we just saw each other yesterday. We pick up right where we left off, and there are, not everyone's like that, and it's hard, I don't know what the X factor is on that, you know, but I think it's also interesting, but I think distance, there is something we miss in the distance, in the sense of if you go for a while without seeing someone and then you are physically with them, to kind of be like, oh, this person has changed, or this person is different in a way that didn't translate over Gmail or GChat or whatever. It's not necessarily a bad thing, you know, but I think the nuance of people is missed there. But you're right, it's sort of the modern day letter, and I think that it's just part of our lives. But I think the danger is when we're either initiating our relationships that way, or I think it's hard if that's the majority of our relationships. You know, I think we do have to have the physical people in our space. I think to rely more fully on people who are all at a distance is hard. Yeah, but
a lot of people in similar situations do. It's not a full substitute, but a lot of people use Skype a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the visual, some kind of visual anyway.
Yeah.
But, especially as you point out, Tom, if you've got a real life relationship to build on,
mm-hmm.
Family separated or friends separated,
mm-hmm.
you know, something that's very important and very real and helpful in a good way.
Yeah.
That's where you can imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think they would mind me saying this. There was a guy who was a worker here, a single worker here a number of years ago, and he married a woman who was a worker at English Libri. And while the period they were engaged, she was still there and he was here, and they Skyped a lot. And I remember him telling me that they would often play Scrabble together over Skype because he was like, we need something not just talking at each other all the time. You know, we don't have the shoulder-to-shoulder thing right now because for this season I'm here and she's there. And so they figured out that playing Scrabble together, she had a board and he had a board, and they both replicated the boards where they were. And I thought, like, oh, that's such a creative, you know, I mean, just a sense of even, it's not the same thing, being in the same place, obviously, and it was for a short season, but I thought that was such an interesting, yeah, way to make it work, yeah. I think I'll wrap it up there. Thank you all so much for your questions.